This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
I appreciate you tuning in to Trumpet Hour today. This is Joel Hilliker. We'll start today's program in Cuba, where protesters are crying out against their communist regime. It's a strong rebuke to the oppressive authoritarian rule that they suffer under, but the White House has been unwilling to say much of anything in support of these protesters. We'll hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Evolution is widely accepted in academic circles, and those who question it are considered anti-science and backward. Well, now there's a new charge being made against evolution deniers. In the oldest magazine in America, Scientific American, they now say that to deny evolution is actually a form of white supremacy. We'll hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. The queen of Jerusalem archaeology, Dr. Eilat Mazar, died in May, but before she did, she was able to publish the results from two recent finds, which we will learn about in a report from Chris Eames, the archaeology contributor of the Trumpet's sister website, Watch Jerusalem. And we'll finish today's program with a last word from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the Summer Olympics, which begin in a week and a half in Tokyo, Japan. After a year of delay, although it will be performed without fans, but still these games held every 4 years have an ability to inspire audiences like virtually no other sporting event. We'll hear about the history of the Olympics and some spiritual lessons we can draw from them. So we have a lot to get to on today's program. We'll start by hearing about the drama in Cuba in this report from Richard Palmer.
Unprecedented protests broke out in Cuba yesterday. Chanting freedom and down with the dictatorship, thousands marched in cities across the country. One demonstrator told the Washington Post, "I have never seen such a protest in my life." Another said, "This is pretty massive. My sense is that this is a combination of social unrest based on lack of freedoms and COVID and economic conditions. The lack of access to electricity, the blackouts. People are screaming for freedom." But they weren't screaming very much from the White House. The first statement from the administration came from Julie Chung, the acting assistant secretary in the State Department Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs. "Peaceful protests are growing in Cuba," she tweeted, "as the Cuban people exercise their right to peaceful assembly and to express concerns about rising COVID cases/deaths and medicine shortages. We commend the numerous efforts of the Cuban people mobilizing donations to help neighbors in need." Many, including Florida Senator Marco Rubio, were outraged at this response. There is a lot more to these protests than people just, quote, expressing concern about rising COVID cases. "Why are they so uncomfortable coming forward and just condemning this evil socialist Marxist regime?" asked Rubio. Well, I think the answer to why this socialist government in America doesn't want to condemn it is pretty obvious to figure out. Perhaps due to this pressure, United States President Joe Biden finally commented on the protests on Monday. "We stand with the Cuban people in their clarion call for freedom and relief from the tragic grip of the pandemic and from the decades of repression and economic suffering to which they've been subjected by Cuba's authoritarian regime," he said. But does he really stand with the Cuban people? Well, the facts show that this administration does not. In 2014, the Obama administration stepped in to save not the Cuban people, but the communist government. At the time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, "When Russia and Venezuela, the main sponsors of the Castro regime, started suffering in the last few months due to falling oil prices, it looked as if the Castro government could finally collapse. That could have paved the way for democracy to finally prevail for Cubans. What the Castro brothers needed in order to survive was an economic lifeline from their enemy, the United States." And then President Barack Obama provided that lifeline. Urged by Pope Francis, he concluded a deal with the Cuban administration. It required no reforms from the government of Cuba. Instead, it gave the regime international legitimacy. It ended their trade embargo, and it allowed mail and flights between Cuba and the U.S. Tourists, and especially important for Cuba, their cash, flooded in, and the Castros were saved. Mr. Flory wrote that anybody familiar with the Castro regime's track record knows that legitimizing and propping it up is not in the interests of the people of Cuba. This is a bad deal for the Cubans. It was a bad deal for the United States, too. Mr. Flory continued that under the Castro regime, Cuba has acted as one of the Western Hemisphere's major sponsors of terrorism and drug trafficking. For America, this was a disgraceful surrender. The president undid a strategy that the nation has been using for 53 years, a strategy that might have been on the verge of toppling one of the world's most renowned criminal regimes. Now, though, the pressure on the communist government is stronger even in Cuba than any time just about in recent history. Surely a U.S. administration wouldn't stand still and let an opportunity like this pass it by. Well, the Obama administration stood still and ignored a similar opportunity in 2009 when protest was sweeping across Iran in what is now known as the Green Revolution. Jay Solomon wrote about it in his book, The Iran Wars. He wrote, "The agency has contingency plans for supporting democratic uprisings anywhere in the world. This includes providing dissidents with communications, money, in extreme cases, even arms. But in this case, the White House ordered it to stand down. They had a golden opportunity to topple one of America's greatest enemies in the Middle East and even the world, and the White House ordered it stood down." These Cuba protests present a similarly important opportunity. In February, Geopolitical Futures founder George Friedman warned that China could use Cuba as, quote, a lever that threatens the United States as the U.S. threatens China. It talked about how China wants to find a threat near the United States and one that involves maritime access to the globe. The only point from which this can be achieved without placing a major fleet off Long Beach would be Cuba. Cuba's the cork in the bottle that can shut off the bulk of America's overseas trade. It's a convenient base for striking right at the heart of America. America's enemies know the strategic importance. How could the Obama administration be ignorant of it? Well, the answer is that it isn't ignorant. The Obama administration, which is really governing America today through Mr. Biden, does not have America's best interests at heart. It's the only way to explain these repeated decisions that harm America. The Cuban protests provide another opportunity to watch this play out. European leaders back then, and especially Pope Francis, wanted America to open up Cuba. Mr. Obama went along, and this is allowing Europe to gain a foothold on this critical island. What's going to happen this time? Well, the Biden administration's responses will be driven by the same considerations. Now, it's possible that this time around, Europe and the Pope may consider a switch in sides to be in their interest. Now, the Pope lobbied strongly to open up Cuba. Maybe he's disappointed by the Castro regime's response. Maybe he thought they should have done more to bring the Catholic Church in or to draw closer to Europe. In this case, the European Union, the Pope, and then even the Biden administration may end up backing the protesters. But just as under Mr. Obama, the welfare of the Cuban people and the interest of the United States won't be the dominant considerations. Why would a presidential administration work against its own country? That does sound pretty improbable. Well, it's a reflection of an unseen spiritual dimension of America's decline. Mr. Flory writes about this in his book, Great Again. "The nation's foreign policy is utterly transformed," he wrote. "We have seen apologies, concessions, and surrenders made to dictators and despots, while longtime alliances like those with the United Kingdom and the Jewish state of Israel have been cast aside. Nations that have relied on America for leadership, strength, security, protection, and largesse face a new reality and are having to forge alternate relationships, even if they undermine America." There is a spiritual dimension to America's decline that most people do not see, he said. "The crisis facing this nation is not because of a bad president. The cause is far deeper, but most are unwilling to face it." That booklet explains that deeper cause. It explains what is happening in America. It has a chapter on Cuba. But more importantly, it describes the real roots of America's decline, where it is leading, and what you can do about it. As with all of our literature, all of our material, we'll be more than happy to send you a free copy of Great Again today.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
If you are willing to consider the scientific evidence against evolution, you are considered anti-science. But according to a new report in a distinguished scientific magazine, You're even worse than that, as we'll hear now in this report from Andrew Miller.
Forty 40% of Americans believe God created humans in his image within the past 10,000 years. The rest believe humans evolved over millions of years, with or without God's guidance. Most college-educated people believe the hypothesis of evolution is a rational explanation for creation. So it should not be surprising that a popular science magazine like the Scientific American espouses it. What is surprising is the level of vitriol this publication levels at anyone who questions evolution. On July 5th, the Scientific American published an editorial by Allison Hooper titled, "Denial of Evolution is a Form of White Supremacy." Since Hooper cannot accept that anyone would ever doubt evolution on scientific or religious grounds, she argues that creationists reject evolution because they are racist. In her article, she writes, "I want to unmask the lie that evolution denial is about religion and recognize that at its core, it is a form of white supremacy that perpetuates segregation and violence against black bodies. In literal interpretations of the Christian Bible, white skin was created in God's image," she continues. "Dark skin has a different, more problematic origin. As the biblical story goes, the curse or mark of Cain for killing his brother was a darkening of his descendant's skin. Historically, many congregations in the U.S. pointed to this story of Cain as evidence that black skin was created as a punishment. The fantasy of a continuous line of white descendants segregates white heritage from black bodies. In the real world, this mythology translates into lethal effects on people who are black. Fundamentalist interpretations of the Bible are part of a fake news epidemic that feeds the racial divide in our country." Now, Hooper is partially correct that some Christian denominations in the United States formally taught that Cain was marked with black skin. But this belief is no longer prevalent, and it never came from the Bible. In Genesis 4, verse 15, the Hebrew word for mark is oath, and it indicates a boundary marker that God set up to segregate Cain and his family from the rest of humanity after he murdered his brother Abel. You can read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and you will not find anything justifying the belief of any one race or ethnicity being inferior to another. The Old Testament refers to Eve as the mother of all living, and the New Testament says God made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth. Yet just as God created varieties within different plants and animals with artistry and purpose, he created varieties of people. In his landmark book, Mystery of the Ages, the late Herbert W. Armstrong writes, "God does not reveal in the Bible the precise origin of the different races, but it is a fair conjecture that in Mother Eve were created ovaries containing the yellow and black genes as well as white, so that some of the children of Adam and Eve gave rise to black, yellow, as well as white." So despite Hooper's protestations, the Bible teaches that God made of one blood all nations of men, and it is actually evolution that teaches some races are inferior to others. The alternate title for Charles Darwin's book On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection was The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, and its premise was that only the fittest races survive. This book's sequel, The Descent of Man, argues that some races were superior to others. Throughout The Descent of Man, Darwin labeled various races as inferior to Europeans. In one passage, he said he would rather be descended from an old baboon than from a South American Indian. And in another passage, he predicted the extinction of the African races. In this passage, he writes, "At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, even than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla." Yet according to the Scientific American, creationists are somehow white supremacists because they reject a theory formulated by a man who believed that blacks and aboriginals were barely more evolved than gorillas. And they are somehow racist because they cling to a religion that teaches that all races were created in the image of God. Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, used the ideas elucidated in The Preservation of Favored Races and the Struggle for Life to start the eugenics movement. This movement sought to improve humanity by excluding inferior peoples from the gene pool. Imperial Germany used tenets of social Darwinism and eugenics to justify the genocide of inferior races in Africa, and National Socialist Germany used principles of social Darwinism and eugenics to justify the genocide of the Jewish people. And whether they realize it or not, those racial activists espousing critical race theory today are channeling the same Darwinian spirit when they substitute race conflict for class conflict in their quest to create a revolutionary coalition of ethnic minorities against a white majority. Those who follow the Bible know that morality is God's definition of right and wrong. But those who believe in evolution think morality is an invention of the human mind. Therefore, evolutionists believe humans can alter the definition of right and wrong at will because they are the authority that invented right and wrong in the first place. After all, if humans are only the most sophisticated of the apes, then the rule of law must give way to the rule of the jungle. The strong rule of the weak, only the fittest survive. Race war, genocide, and other serious problems are not caused by literal interpretations of the Bible, but are instead caused by society's rejection of literal interpretations of the Bible. Mr. Armstrong continues in Mystery of the Ages, higher education during the 20th century has come with virtual unanimity to accept the evolutionary theory. Higher education contemptuously ignores without consideration whatsoever the biblical truth revealing man's presence on earth and the cause of the present state of civilization. Education in the civilized world today has become entirely materialistic. Education has become a combination of the agnosticism of evolution, the politics and economics of Karl Marx, and the morals and social patterns of Sigmund Freud. So, until humanity comes to understand the mystery of mankind and of human civilization, and accept God's inexorable spiritual laws as static, stationary, eternal, and unchanging, we stand in great danger. And unless the Creator, whose existence evolutionists so adamantly deny, intervenes to save this world's sick society, social Darwinism and moral relativism will lead to the extinction of all life on Earth.
The Queen of Jerusalem Archaeology, Dr. Eilat Mizar, died this past May, but first she was able to publish the results from two recent finds, which we'll learn about now in this report from Watch Jerusalem's archaeology contributor, Chris Eames.
Hi, I'm Chris Eames, archaeology contributor for the sister website of thetrumpet.com, watchjerusalem.co.il. As many of our listeners know, our beloved archaeologist, Dr. Eilat Mizar, died recently, and we shared a lengthy archaeological partnership with her, spanning decades, going right back to her grandfather, Professor Benjamin Mizar, and Mr. Armstrong in the 1960s, 1968 to be specific. And over the years, Dr. Mizar has made numerous important discoveries for the world of biblical archaeology, and we've had the privilege to be a part of those, to work alongside her to make those discoveries. Just to rattle off a few of them, there's her discovery of King David's palace, King Solomon's walls, King Solomon's gate, Nehemiah's wall, there's a possible tower of Uzziah. personal seal stamps that prove the existence of numerous biblical figures, such as King Hezekiah, the prophet Isaiah, the prince Jehukal, the prince Shelemiah, the prince Gedaliah, and the prince Pasher. And she's found one of the largest gold hoards in all Israel, coin hoards, Phoenician graves, weapons, idols, jewelry. You can just go on and on with the discoveries that she's made. And she's noted that even among other archaeologists, she's been shocked by the amount of discoveries that she's made. Many archaeologists spend their whole life in the field and only make a small fraction of the discoveries that Dr. Elat Mazar has made. For this segment, though, I want to talk a bit about the last discoveries that she left us with. You might remember her famous unveiling of the Isaiah Bulla in 2018, but since that time, she's really struggled with her physical condition to the point of being able to do very little at all. But the Isaiah Bulla wasn't her last release of a discovery. Her very last discovery release happened this very year, just a few weeks before she died. And the discoveries that these were are quite special. There are two of them. One huge discovery in terms of size, and again in terms of size, one tiny discovery. And both of these are related to her grandfather's excavations on the Temple Mount with the ambassador students in the 60s and 70s. Now, this was all released to the public for the first time in the month of April with the publication of her last big book entitled Jerusalem's Temple Mount Monumental Staircases. And I'll say right now, this is what really set Dr. Mazar apart and above other archaeologists in the field in Israel. She's known for this. An archaeologist mentioned it in a commemorative statement of her after her death, that she is a zealous publisher. What she finds, she's diligent to publish right away. And on the flip side, many other archaeologists have died before getting around to publish their work. And so in some ways, this was the modus operandi for Dr. Elat Mazar writing this book. It was part of her effort to conclude publications for her late grandfather's work, Professor Benjamin Mazar, his work from the 1960s and 70s Temple Mount excavations. So that's what this new publication is about. It's a sort of conclusion to his work, which Dr. Elat Mazar took on as her own. And it's become a conclusion to her work, too. There's a couple new items in here that we'll go through on this segment, never before released to the public, that were finally published just weeks before she died. And these finds were released with a lot less fanfare because Dr. Mazar didn't want journalists to find out about her physical condition. But they are, nonetheless, very significant. So we'll start with the biggest one in terms of size. One of the most famous features of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem is Robinson's Arch, or the remains of what is known as Robinson's Arch, built by King Herod, which originally formed a grand arched bridge-like entryway into the Temple Mount complex. And today, all that's left of this massive arched bridge pier entrance sort of thing that went into the Temple Mount, all that's left of it is the edge of it that's still attached to the Temple Mount wall. But from that alone, we know that this pier stood about 70 feet above the ground, and the walkway was over 40 feet wide, so a really grand staircase that went into the Temple Mount. Now, during Professor Benjamin Mazar's excavations around the base of the Temple Mount in the 70s, he uncovered the foundations of the piers for the staircase leading into the Temple Mount. But based on their preliminary discoveries, they thought that this was just a one-way staircase, a one-way walkway that led up from the ground level, made a right-angle turn, and continued on up the 70 feet into the Temple Mount. And then there's another, perhaps less popular theory, that perhaps this was a two-way staircase. Well, what Dr. Mazar discovered, Dr. Elat Mazar, in poring through her grandfather's excavation maps, his discoveries, is that this must have been, in fact, a massive four-way staircase built by Herod leading up into the Temple Mount. That this 7-foot-high, 2,000-year-old staircase originally went north into the city. It went east into the Temple Mount. It divided south into the city of David, and then west across the Tiripoyan Valley to the upper city of Jerusalem. And this is all indicated by Dr. Mazar's reassessment of those foundational remains discovered at that southwest corner of the Temple Mount by her grandfather. And it came as a surprise, really, because as Dr. Mazar writes about it, quote, "With four turns, not the one suggested by Benjamin Mazar, this was a four-way monumental staircase unique among the structures of the classical world," end of quote. And Dr. Mazar also connected this with what Josephus, the ancient historian, wrote, and he mentions a grand four-way staircase in the city. So this all shows that King Herod then, the so-called great builder of Jerusalem, he constructed Jerusalem in an even grander and more fantastical manner than was previously expected. And this was, of course, the King Herod of the Bible, the Herod who attempted to kill the Christ child. And really, he was a maniacal leader who, alongside undertaking all these incredible building projects in Jerusalem, Caesarea, Herodium, Masada, the list goes on, besides the incredible building projects, he also committed numerous atrocious acts throughout his reign. And archaeology attests to that as well. So this massive four-way vaulted staircase then makes up architecture that Jesus himself would have been familiar with, that he would have undoubtedly walked along during his time here on earth. And then added to all this, Dr. Mazar also discovered that the urban area beneath that staircase, it became built up and used only during the rule of the infamous Pontius Pilate. So New Testament connections throughout this discovery. But as we know, all of this grandeur, all of these incredible buildings that Herod built up, they came crashing down and destroyed barely a few decades later during the Roman siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And that was something, again, that was prophesied in the Bible, and the remains of which destruction can be seen all over the ground underneath Robinson's Arch. Gigantic, beautiful ashlar stones that you can see in massive piles there at the bottom of the wall, collapsed into heaps. The other discovery made by Dr. Elat Mazar and released to the public for the first time this year, it also came from her grandfather's excavations, and it dates to the same period, but it's on the opposite end of the size spectrum. It's a truly tiny object. It's a little gold ring, so small that it could have only fit the finger of a baby. And as such, Dr. Mazar believes it to be a baby's ring. A tiny little gold ring, and it has an emblem on it. The famous Jewish symbol, a seven-branched menorah emblem. Dr. Mazar drew attention to the fact that this menorah ring, where it was found, was probably only around 200 yards away from where the real menorah was in the temple itself, the real gold menorah at that time. Now, the design of the menorah on this ring was a little bit more abstract, but it does parallel menorah drawings of around that period in other ancient artwork. And I think we can link this discovery to the Bible as well. A baby's ring, you might say. What would a baby want with a golden ring? Well, if you read Matthew 2, verse 11, you'll see that the three wise men that came to see Jesus as a baby brought, quote, treasures, and they presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And if you look at this Greek word gold, it can mean stamped gold, gold ornaments, gold jewelry. So could this baby's ring discovery, paired up with this Bible verse, could it attest to a practice at the time, perhaps, of gifting babies something like a gold ring, something that only a baby could fit? The two pair up quite well with each other, I think, this discovery and this biblical verse. And if you wanted to get even more sensational, you could ask, was this the very baby's ring of Jesus himself? And regarding this discovery, if I perhaps can get a bit poetic without getting too carried away, I think this final discovery is really special because, as we know, In the Bible, the menorah represents God's light and God's work. And even though Dr. Mazar has died recently, it seems like this is just a little symbol that that light is going to keep burning, that this work of excavating Jerusalem in her footsteps will continue. So that about sums up the latest and last of Dr. Eilat Mazar's discoveries, the biggest and the smallest, so to speak, discoveries that really bring her life's work full circle, right back to her years as a child, working with her grandfather and the ambassador students in the 60s and 70s. These discoveries really help illustrate her own life and dedication to the work that she was a part of as she has been memorialized, a queen of Jerusalem archaeology.
Thank you very much for that report, Chris. I liked the poetry there at the end of the report.
You worked with her quite a lot. Talk about your personal observations about her legacy and what it was like to work with her.
Okay, sure. Thank you very much. By the way, it's a pleasure to be on. Now I've had the chance to work with Dr. Mazar for a few excavations, and something I really noticed right from the outset, she really includes you in the excavations and gets you thinking, and she wants to know what you think. She's kind of an unusual scholar in that way, in that she has a very open mind to other people's opinions. And so she'll go around the dig and she'll be really engaged with her excavators, trying to get an idea of what they think as they're excavating, any theories, any ideas that they've got. And it's the same with whoever she tours around the dig site. She's got a very inquisitive, open, searching mind. And that was really necessary for her to develop her own theories and come to her own conclusions, just that searching for other people's input. And it also leads to her actively trying to get her workers to be better and to do a better job or to be more incorporated in the excavation effort. And so in my case, I had the opportunity to work as a regular volunteer for the first excavation. For the second one, she gave me the opportunity to be an assistant area supervisor. And then for the latest one, again, to be an area supervisor. So she has this real sense of not just getting the job done itself, but looking to really help and encourage and kind of better her employees in that work and help them succeed in the field. And she really looks for criticism or other ideas or working to refine her own ideas on the dig site. So that was one of the really special things about Dr. Mazar. And of course, everyone talks about her as a motherly figure.
Yeah.
She really invites you into her life. And that's the case on the dig site. She really pays attention to what's going on in your life. She'll talk with you on very deep personal levels. She'll bring you around to her house. She'll have you ask the blessing on the dinner. And she's just a really engaging person, really interested in people's lives. But she's very much a business woman as well. She runs a very tight ship. And she does have criticism, obviously, about some of her conclusions, but and we talk about those a lot on our website, Watch Jerusalem. But she really is top of her class as an archaeologist. No one can really hold a candle to her. And sometimes we'll have volunteer excavators come to the dig site from other dig sites and say that Dr. Mazar's ones are just remarkable compared to these other excavation sites. The way she runs such a tight ship, the documentation, the data that she collects, she's really a cut above as far as just straight archaeology goes. And if there are any problems or anyone's causing any issues on the dig site, she's got no problem taking that business mindset and sorting things out. So she's a very business orientated person, but a very motherly person as well. And here I am talking about her in the present tense.
Right.
But
I did notice that.
yeah. It's it's kind of hard to believe that she's died, actually. And it took a lot of people by surprise. A lot of people were in shock about that. And a lot of people have such fond memories of her, which was discussed last night in a memorial service for her. So I think with her death, it's awakened in a lot of people, several different archaeologists that have worked with her, this need to continue in her footsteps of doing biblical archaeology, that someone needs to come in and fill her shoes, as it were.
Well, we certainly hope that that is the case, and we want to do everything that we can to aid in that effort to ensure that her legacy continues, because there is a whole lot more work to be done. And if her death actually awakened a greater appetite for that in more people, then that is certainly a positive development. We've been talking with Watch Jerusalem's archaeology contributor Chris Eames about the late Dr. Elat Mazar and the final finds that were published just before she died this past May. We have several articles on watchjerusalem.co.il about this. We'll link to these in the show notes about that four-way staircase, the 2,000-year-old gold ring. And there's actually a podcast from Watch Jerusalem editor Brent Noctegal on that staircase as well that you can watch. Thank you very much, Chris. We really appreciate your contribution here.
Thank you, Mr. Hilke. Good to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
After 1 year of delay, the Tokyo Summer Olympics are now just around the corner, scheduled to begin on July 23rd. In pools and lakes, on tracks and trampolines, around the velodrome, and even in the sumo wrestler's dojo, the world's best athletes will come together to compete and to take part in a tradition that spans back millennia. Starting back in the 8th century BC, in a place called Olympia in Greece, the Olympic Games have captured the attention of sports enthusiasts and most everyone else who has watched them. In the modern era, the Games have consistently transcended the typical sports markets, captivating attention worldwide as little else can. They've connected spectators with the global community, and they've also allowed for a riveting microcosmic view of national rivalries and competitions. But the main reason we get so absorbed in the Olympics is to witness all its displays of sheer, truly world-class athleticism. In ancient Greece, many Olympians were striving to emulate the valiant traits of Homeric warriors. Many of these early participants lived during times of peace, but they were deeply inspired by the strength of Ajax and the speed of Achilles, the vigor of Ulysses, and the arete, meaning excellence or character, of Diomedes. The ancient Greeks' desire to build these Homeric ideals of a warrior's arete, even during times of peace, propelled many of them to compete in the Olympics. And there, through dazzling feats, they pursued glory on the fields of athletics instead of on the fields of battle. In the modern technological era, Olympic athletes have many of the same underlying goals. They strive to eclipse records against the measuring tape and stopwatch in pursuit of precise and exacting excellence. Their quest for triumph pits them not only against their contemporary competitors, but also against every athlete who has lived and set records before them. This ambitious pursuit cannot be undertaken without great quantities of arete. The Holy Bible draws on examples of elite-level athletics to teach readers some profound lessons. The Olympic Games were enormously popular during the first century AD when the Apostle Paul lived, and his familiarity with competitive sports spawned several of his most effective analogies. Every 4 years, the Isthmian Games took place, and these were like the Olympic Games in every way except the place where they happened. The Isthmian Games took place in the narrow part of the Isthmus of Corinth, and one of Paul's major congregations was based right there. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary points out that Paul's sports analogies would have been especially impacting for these church members in Corinth because, quote, "The Isthmian Games were to the Greeks rather a passion than a mere amusement, hence their suitableness as an image of Christian earnestness. These competitions were a subject of patriotic pride to the Corinthians, who lived in the immediate neighborhood." End quote. And so the Apostle Paul was well aware of the enormous popularity of the Olympic Games and the Isthmian Games, and he told church members in Corinth that the life of a Christian is similar in some key ways to the quest for victory that they saw in the runners who competed in the games. In 1 Corinthians 9:24, he stated, quote, "Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain." Paul was telling each of them to give their very best to God. He was telling them to run, so to speak, with everything they had. And he pointed out that the stakes for the aspiring Christian are far higher than those of an Olympic athlete. In verse 25, he wrote, "Now they push themselves to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible." Paul explained that he personally exerted himself to the utmost so that he would not fail to secure that incorruptible crown of eternal life. In verses 26 and 27, he wrote, "I therefore so run, not as uncertainly. So fight I, not as one that beats the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means when I've preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." So he was pointing not just to the runners there as an analogy, but also to boxers. And this passage in 1 Corinthians is just one of several places where the Apostle Paul pointed his Christian brothers to the finest athletes of their day. It was an analogy that he often employed because these athletes, like today's contenders, were brimming with passion, zeal, and a deep-rooted drive to demonstrate arete in their sports, even though doing so required them to bring their bodies into subjection with the most arduous training regimens. The Bible, in passages such as Isaiah 59:17, makes plain that zeal is fundamental to the life of a Christian. And it shows in scriptures such as Proverbs 25:28 that self-discipline is an absolute necessity for anyone striving to live like Christ. The Bible reveals in Colossians 3:23 that Christians must struggle to invest their hearts deeply into all that they do. And Matthew 5:48 shows that they must strive to become perfect. Philippians 4:4 shows that on top of all this, they have to do all of that with joy. It is true that Olympic competitions can often become a microcosm of the rivalries between various countries, and they can sometimes demonstrate the ugly side of competitiveness. But the athleticism that's on display can also occasion the noblest zeal and passion, and it can showcase the heights that the human spirit is capable of achieving. If you join the hundreds of millions who will be tuning in to the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer, think about the self-discipline required for these world-class athletes to have achieved such mastery over themselves. Reflect on the sheer effort they exert in their quest for excellence and in their drive to bring home a medal. And most importantly, spend some time contemplating the spiritual parallels.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, Chris Eames, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to Jeremiah and Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. "Every great and commanding moment in the annals of the world is the triumph of some enthusiasm." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.